Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Martin today with Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Today we ask, does the payment for order flow model deserve criticism? Does it largely benefit, or are there conflict of interest issues that are important for investors to be aware of when choosing their brokerages? Also, energy counters and financial stocks, are they big gainers in the U.S. this amid all those fears about where interest rates are going? And inflation fears? I'm going to put that question to Arun also. Yesterday, you may have heard on this program, my guest saying he believes that there is more upward price, more headroom for silver. I ask Arun to weigh in on the debate. And you heard in the Singapore budget so much talk about investment in electric vehicles. So if EV is going to be the way of the future, what are the possible beneficiaries from this push to a roadmap for electric vehicles in Singapore? What can investors look to? Arun will weigh in on all those questions. First up, let's say good morning. How are you, Arun?
I am very good, Michelle. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with me. So one of the sources that you like to cite quite frequently on this show, Charlie Munger in the news, weighing in on Robinhood's free trade model. So the vice chair and Warren Buffett's longtime business partner, vice chair of Berkshire Hathaway, has issued a dire warning on the momentum trading activity that we saw with GameStop, saying novice traders are being enticed by the free trade model. He said it's most egregious in the momentum trade by novice investors lured in by new types of brokerage operations like Robinhood. No one should believe Robinhood trades are free. And he said this frenzy is being fed by people who are getting commissions and other revenues out of this new bunch of gamblers. And at a congressional hearing, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the U.S. asked Robinhood directly if it would pass on the commissions from payments for orders to consumers. And it's not just Robinhood. Many brokerages, Charles Schwab, E-Trade, TD Ameritrade, they all generate significant revenue from this business model premised on payment for order flows. Where do you stand on the debate, Arun? Do you think that this payment for order flow model is an efficient way to trade, or does it harm customers?
I think it's definitely immoral. And the reason I say that is because the average retail investor kind of has like odds stacked against him or her already by being in this market space. And the reason I say that is, you know, hedge funds have the access to a whole plethora of information and data points, extremely, you know, sophisticated technology to be able to trade in and out if required, or get access to, and they just have access to like large pools of capital to potentially swing the markets. On top of that, you have like these platforms that have come on and are basically advertising stuff for free, which kind of creates very perverse incentives where if you say something is free and, you know, okay, in a way it is, it encourages a whole lot of participants who might not have been wanting to come into this space to actually play in this space. Now, you compare that to, you know, like if you just come up with an advertisement, like, you know, a hypothetical Robinhood ad, free trades, but the information that we are taking from these trades, we will be taking it and giving it to large hedge funds. How many people do you think would bite on that? Like, not nowhere nearly as many as what is happening right now. And it's really strange because it kind of takes me back to when I started investing, right? I remember the first stock I bought was back in 2003 as a freshman in university. I bought it through a platform called E-Trade that still exists. And I think the commission I paid was roughly $12.99, give or take. Thanks to technology, like really, you know, kudos to the fact of democratizing investments, which I believe is something that's the core strength of the capital markets in the U.S. the technology has managed to bring down those commissions, which might have been prohibitive for a retail investor who might only want to invest like $100 or $200, leading to commissions to be like 10, 12%. They brought that down to like $1 or $5. And that's because of the use of technology, which I'm completely for. But making it free just to try and, you know, hang out a little treat to a person to just come in and open the account for free, we'll give you some depository money for free and go about trading for free, and it's like unlimited money that's out there and all of that stuff, I think it just creates incentives that are not in the right direction. And that's exactly what, you know, Charlie Munger was saying last night.
So are there conflict of interest issues that are important for investors to be aware of when they choose their brokerages? You know, I like to try out different brokerages, and all of a sudden, the one that I was trying out decided to restrict trading. It was one of those that restricted GameStop selling, I believe. And it also just recently decided to make changes, raising the minimum first-time deposit. And this after there were service disruptions. And I thought, gosh, this is a brokerage whose business model is not ready to cope with a huge influx of people jumping in. So that set off my red flags. What do you think? What should investors be aware of when they choose their brokerages?
Right. Now the whole, you know, build fast, break fast, or like build quickly and then fail quickly, all of these like famous idioms that are going on, or phrases that is going on in Silicon Valley, is fantastic for, you know, a B2C model where you're trying to order a new pair of jeans or something, right? And that's completely fine. If you're sharing like your cat photos or dog photos and one of them gets corrupted and it doesn't get uploaded, completely fine. It does not work in the financial ecosystem. And that is because this is, you know, a person's hard-earned savings that they're looking to deploy. And that's exactly why you have so much regulation in this space. You have the governments, you have central banks, you have all these various rules in place to ensure that you can't just have a newcomer come in having a setup that might be great for 5 or 10 people, but not so great for 50,000 people. The MAS in Singapore, you know, they want to encourage innovation, and that's why they created the sandbox. So whenever a fintech company is there in the sandbox, they have to let its customers know, I'm in the sandbox, this is a little kiddie area, please be cognizant that my app might break down or something else might happen. We have all these safety nets in place, but don't take me wrong, we are still a small startup company. Now, to address this issue of conflicts of interest, I would probably like split it up into two parts.
Okay.
First and foremost, the aspect of, you know, force selling people's GameStop shares and all of that stuff. This was not just a Robin Hood or, you know, a new tech comer. This was even like your really large companies like Interactive Brokers that are publicly traded $30, $40, $50 billion market cap companies. And the fundamental reason for this is because of unprecedented volatility in the underlying, the clearing houses basically required a much larger margin than what these brokerages were prepared for. So I would kind of probably take that, the aspect of force selling GameStop out of the way, but focus more on if there are issues like, you know, this really sad case that I read of a person committing suicide because the graphic user interface of one of these brokerage platforms basically said the person was down $300,000 or something when the person had only put in $10,000. It was a complete error on the part of this platform, and that sadly caused the person to lose their life. And these are cases which should never, ever happen, and it cannot happen, especially in like a heavily regulated space. So from that regard, especially from the latter, which is a lot more scarier, I think it's really important that when a consumer, or in this case, you know, a listener of your show who's saved a lot of his or her money and is trying to pick out a certain platform, to be extremely careful and not just go for something that is free. Because sure, you might be, instead of paying a $3 commission, you're paying nothing, quote unquote, in commission, first and foremost, though, all of that information is being sent across to the big, larger hedge funds who are monetizing this information, obviously, and thereby potentially front-running you or potentially like doing a whole host of other things. And on the other hand, it's like, you know, when you go out and try to buy a car, you look at what the safety metrics are, you look at what the credibility is, you look at the after-sales service, et cetera, et cetera. So keep those principles in mind when you're looking to deposit your money into any platform or any kind of investment, robo-advisor or anything else, because it is your hard-earned money and you need to know a lot more about the underlying track record, any complaints that they've received, are there any issues or lawsuits with, you know, be it the Federal Reserve or in this case like the MAS, and you need to be very cognizant of that before deploying your capital.
Great, wise words, Arun. Thank you for that. Now, when it comes to stocks and these inflation jitters, Jerome Powell has tried to pour water on inflationary fears, but we know that investors have become concerned about rising bond yields and U.S. Treasury bond yields moving higher. Do you see tech stocks being safe from these bond market jitters?
It's funny you mentioned inflation. Michael Burry of you know, the Big Short fame, he tweeted a couple of days back saying, you know, all these media publications claim that I was not, you know, voicing my opinion loud enough back in 2006, 2007, 2008 regarding the mortgage crisis. But believe you me, I'm shouting it out as loud as possible. Inflation is going to come back, and this is going to bite a lot of people in their portfolios quite substantially.
Wow. So, and he speaks, you want to listen, yes.
Something to watch out for. And, you know, we talk about this quite often in your show, right, where you've got a number of people coming onto the platform saying, onto your show, sorry, saying, you know, inflation is not going to be that big a concern. But that's the beauty of financial markets, right? You'll always have a buyer and a seller, and that's what makes the market tick.
So do you agree with Burry?
To some extent, I actually do. I think technology has played a very large role in ensuring that some aspects of our day-to-day deployment of capital to buy certain goods will always stay at a very attractive price. But that being said, just the sheer amount of capital and just the 10 years of basically zero interest rates, something has to give. It's just impossible to see this continuing for, let me put it this way. I would be shocked if we're sitting here 10 years from now and we've not seen inflation come back. And obviously, you know, 10 years is a very long time duration, but something that Michael Burry brings to the attention of his listeners and viewers was just go back to the 1980s, take a look at Warren Buffett's shareholder letters, which are freely available on BerkshireHathaway.com. And he talks about how inflation can eat into substantially the profitability of many companies and the whole future, you know, PVing down or present valuing the future earnings of a company starts changing quite substantially because of inflation and when your interest rates rise, thereby bringing down the share prices quite heavily in today's day and age. So from that perspective, I think it's something that people should, you know, watch out for quite a bit. And, you know, the inflation, whether it comes or not comes, kind of like what we talked about last week, it's something that investors should be hedging themselves against to some extent and having some allocation of their portfolio to protect themselves against it.
Well, I love the bibliography that you've given us. Thank you for that. Speaking of Warren Buffett, he lately has been doubling down on his energy investments and trimming his tech and banking holdings. What do you think of those moves and should we follow suit?
Banking segment, I'm a bit surprised that he did that, and it kind of goes against what my position is. So, you know, it's made me look and relook at my investments. I personally, and probably this is the only time I'll be saying this on your show, I personally am quite, you know, quite bullish on U.S. banks. I think NPLs is obviously going to be a huge issue, and that's something that we are seeing in my fintech company across the Southeast Asian region. The U.S., though, I think is a little bit of a different story altogether, where they have, you know, their balance sheets are literally like Fort Knox. And I think that if anything, They might take advantage, or not might, they will take advantage of weakness in European as well as Asian banks and potentially start to expand a little bit more. So from that regard, I personally am staying put in my financial stocks, coupled with the fact that the yield curve is steepening quite substantially. So once again, you know, when the yield curve steepens, that's very favorable to banks because they're receiving deposits from borrowers. And basically, they need to pay out 0%. The loans that they're issuing at 10-year, 20-year, 30-year tenors are going to be at a much higher price because they are set at whatever treasuries are plus a certain credit spread. So from that regard, I personally am still quite a big fan of U.S. financials. Energy is something that I started scaling in at the beginning of the year on the back of, I personally believe that vaccinations are going to be rolled out much quicker than what people are anticipating. Yes, there will be many, you know, issues and cases related to various variations of the coronavirus coming back on. But I believe that, you know, overall, it's not going to be a systemic risk to the health sector. And that will enable people to start traveling a lot more. It'll get the wheels of the economy will start spinning again. Geopolitical tensions have decreased significantly since November. So personally, post that in December itself, I started scaling into energy stocks. And I think I'm relatively comfortable about that. The aspect of people or investors going into, you know, maybe more energy than even financial, and for that matter, to some extent, financial too, excluding Warren Buffett, obviously. I think it's got a lot to do with people looking at their portfolio, seeing a massive increase of exposure to technology stocks. And I don't mean just FANG over here. I mean like a whole host of other stocks that benefited because of this whole work from home COVID pandemic situation. And they realize, okay, should I be involved in this stock that's like trading at a 200, 300 price to earnings multiple, in which I've already, you know, appreciated my portfolio by like 50% or doubled up my money? Should I take stuff out, go into, you know, the more industrial, the more energy stocks that are relatively attractive based on valuations, at least, and see how this year evolves? I think it's a little bit of a combination of all of these factors.
Well, thank you for sharing so openly with us. Now, when it comes to energy stocks, we know, you know, there are things for, like electric car batteries or solar panels or cell phones. Many of these industries depend on that daily essential silver, absolute necessity for many of these industries. Do you think that there is, and we've talked about the conditions that set the stage for silver to move forward. But amidst this context of inflationary fears, and we know that one purpose of silver is a hedge against inflation, much like gold, is there room for silver to go even further this year? It had quite a stellar year last year.
It did. And, you know, personally, I don't take investments into underlying commodities by buying futures or forwards itself, because I think there's just it's macro investing, right? And there are just so many different factors at play that I would rather buy into companies that have a cost plus margin model in which they use these underlying, you know, be it metals or minerals, they use that and they provide a service on top of that. That enables me to try and analyze the company's strength, see if it has a good competitive moat around it, whether it can basically take its increasing costs and try and pass that down the supply chain. So I personally go for companies like that. But that being said, though, you know, silver itself, be it gold or potentially, I would rather stick to more usable metals like silver, nickel, all of the ones that are used in like the EV space especially, I think is extremely interesting. And all these like rare earth miners, I think there's a lot of potential in these companies if they can keep their competitive edge. And that means, like, you know, just because they know that their underlying good is in high demand doesn't mean that you slack off on trying to continuously upgrade your equipment, ensure that you have really solid, robust supply chains in place to ensure that you can try and keep as much cost savings as possible and pass on all the appreciation of the underlying material to the person who buys stuff from you.
Okay. You know, last week you talked about the roadmap Singapore has and sustainable investing as a theme. And I wonder if you can expand on that a little bit. So if we looked at Singapore's game plan for electric vehicles and you look downstream, where do you see opportunities for investors? Some say nickel miners, battery manufacturers, chip makers, maybe even Viacom, vehicle testing companies here in Singapore. Since we do not have direct EV players in Singapore, where do you think investors can look to companies that could be possible beneficiaries from our push to electric vehicles here in Singapore?
Right. So, you know, Singapore, as great as the country is and what the fantastic things that it's achieved, it's just too small a market for it to make a massive dent in any specific, like any of the larger companies, at least, just because of the small market underlying. That being said, though, Singapore, China, Europe, and now the US, they have gone scaled massively into this EV space. So personally, I'm not looking at the end product of the company. Like I'm not looking at definitely not Tesla, nor NIO, nor any of these other electric vehicles that have gone public through SPACs or anything. I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at more of what the underlying, you know, either the pick and shovel approach where I don't want to be the person to spend 20 hours a day trying to find the gold. I would rather have a steady source of income by selling shovels to the gold miners. So looking at, you know, companies like either ChargePoint, EV Box, Blink Charging, these are people who provide the infrastructure to enable people to charge their cars. So I'm looking at that space quite actively. As you mentioned, semiconductors, batteries, the likes of NVIDIA, Panasonic, respectively, I think those can be some really good plays, contingent to them being able to continuously evolve their technology. And I think NVIDIA definitely stands out quite well in that. And I think, you know, taking an even further step back of taking a look at who produces the energy that charges the vehicles, because eventually, and, you know, apologies for the pun, people will eventually look under the hood and try to see, okay, I love this whole ESG aspect of buying a Tesla, for example, but if the energy derived to charge my Tesla is coming from like a coal burning plant, it defeats the entire purpose. So, you know, there are all these like really large scale renewable energy producers, and one that came to my mind was Next Era Energy Partners. Berkshire Energy has come up with a huge wind farm, but they do obviously still have a lot of their legacy traditional energy producing sources. But a combination of all of these, like a nice little basket of them, I think in the long run might yield a better result than these 20, you know, names that a lot of consumers know about, of which maybe only two or three will survive, exactly the same way as when Ford, you know, T came out back in the day when car manufacturing was such a big thing, and there were thousands of car manufacturers in the U.S. Now it's down to like three or four, of which two of them went through bankruptcy just 10 years back.
Always fascinating to chat with you, Arun. Thank you for your insights.
My pleasure as always. Thank you for having me, Michelle.
He's Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, joining us in Money and Me.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.